So thanks very much for the invitation to speak here. What I'm going to talk about today is the work that we've been doing to try to use complex comparative developmental genetics to understand the genetic mechanisms that condition of the very first rooting systems that appeared when the plants first colonized the land. And toward the end of the talk, I'm going to talk about some work that's unpublished, and as you'll see from the presentation, is really something that we don't quite understand yet. So I'm looking for input into how to interpret some of these data. And I think those of you with quantitative minds will be able to think about this with much greater clarity than me. So bear out for the last few slides in the presentation. I wanted to introduce the plants and introduce the context of this work and why it's important. So as I said, we're interested in understanding the genetic events that occurred when plants first colonized the land. And so to put that in a historical context, the planet is just over 4.5 billion years old. And around half a billion years ago, plants started to grow on the terrestrial surfaces of the planet. Before that, all primary productivity, and what I mean by primary productivity is photosynthesis. So it's a chemical reaction whereby sun's energy is used to turn carbon dioxide and water into energy-rich molecules like sugar, all took place in the ocean. So it took place initially, it evolved somewhere around here in the cyanobacteria, or the ancestors of cyanobacteria. And then there were endosymbiotic events that gave rise to algae. So these were algae that had plastids that underwent photosynthesis. And then at this stage, these algae stopped being algae and became land plants. And as plants transited from the water onto the land, they were accompanied by a variety of morphological adaptations. So they evolved meristems for the first time. So meristems are generative centers where morphogenesis takes place. And from these morphogenesis centers, shoots develop. So these are the bits of the plant you see above the ground. And they also evolved structures for anchoring these plants in the soil substrate. So these were the roots, and then leaves subsequently evolved on these shoots. So this transition here was accompanied by a massive change in the structure of these photosynthetic organisms. And so schematically represented here is Arabidopsis thaliana with all the bits that make up a typical land plant, shoot, root, meristems here and here to give rise to that morphological diversity. And then this is what the ancestor likely looked like. So they were filamentous. They had relatively small amounts of cellular diversity. And what's important for us is that this cellular diversity and morphological diversity all evolved within a very short period of time. Within 100 million years, plants had gone from something like this to something that's quite similar to this here. And so the aim of our research is to try to get at that. So in addition to there being a change in the structure and organization of plants, this had a dramatic effect on the global environment. So for the first time, we had soils. So soils depend on plants. If you don't have plants, you don't have soils. They completely changed the hydrology of the planet. So meandering rivers, such as the one that you see here, depend entirely on roots to channel the water. So before plants evolved, water moved across the continental surfaces the way it does off a beach. So you get braided river systems where channels coalesce and spread. So it entirely changed the hydrology. But probably the most dramatic change was in the carbon cycle. And we had a dramatic drawdown in carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which is relatively high levels before the evolution of the land plants. But then as land plants evolved, this dramatically reduced. This reduction is due to two processes. One is carbon burial. So plants die and they get buried, and then that removes carbon from the atmosphere, locks it up in the geological record. But more importantly was silicate weathering. This is the reaction that plants catalyze where silicate minerals react with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And then this is buried in the oceans as limestone. And that reaction is catalyzed by roots. So roots are the environmental engineers for this climate change here. So And roots is where we're going to focus for the rest of this talk. So roots come in two flavors in the land plants. We've got the root that most of you will be familiar with from secondary school practicals. You have a plant that's growing up through the roof here. The root grows downwards. And what we have here is the meristem. So this is the generative center. So there's a bunch of stem cells down here. These go through proliferative phase, and then they differentiate in this region here. And what I want you to see is that the surface of the root axis here comprises two types of cells. There are these tip-growing filamentous cells that grow out into the soil. So these cells are only growing at their tip. So they sense the environment at their tip, and then they will grow accordingly around obstacles. These cells are important for nutrient uptake, water uptake, but they play an important role in tethering roots to the soil. So they've got an important role in ensuring that as the root exerts pressure in the soil to penetrate the soil, that the plant doesn't push itself out of the substrate. The other class that we find is the rhizoid-based rooting system. So these are much simpler. And this is exemplified by a moss. So here's a typical moss plant. You've got these leafy bits here. And then there's a beard of filamentous cells. And again, these grow at the very tips. And in this instance, these are multicellular filaments. So all growth is at the tip. So they grow by tip growth. Then cell division takes place back here. And then you get the formation of this filament. So what's common between these two plant types is that the interface between the plant and the soil is occupied by these tip-growing filaments. In this case, the tip-growing filaments develop on specialized rooting axes, the root, whereas here they develop from the underside of the shoot structure. So if we were to look back in the fossil record for evidence of roots, the earliest good evidence that we have comes from fossils that are about 407 million years old. These are preserved in a glass-like chert in northern Scotland. And so we're talking about there's an area up here where these fossils are found. This is a rock. This rock here is about the size of your fist. And all the black stuff in there is plant, okay? So this is an entire ecosystem that was preserved in one catastrophic event. You can polish up these rocks, and in this example here, what you have is an example of the soil surface here, and then these are plants that are growing from the soil surface upwards. So this is like a lawn of grass here. So you've got the soil and grass growing upwards. And then if you look at this from above here, so you polish the rock on this side and look down, you can see the plants coming at you. So these are the plants growing forward. Yeah.
407 seems remarkably precise. How did they get down to precision of 407 million? Like, is that a real precision there?
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's in the last 5 years, it's got very, there's a lot of precision around that day. I can't remember what the standard error on it is, but it's very small. It used to be, there was a lot more variability, but in the last 10 years, they got it down pretty well. And I can't remember what isotopes they're using to date it. But what's most important about these fossils is that the state of the preservation. So what we're doing here is now we're looking at, we're taking one of these, we're sticking on a microscope, and we can see that the cellular outline is preserved. So we can see remarkable detail. And here are the water-conducting tissues that have these very thickened cells that grow out. So in this environment, this 407 million-year-old environment, that we've got our first evidence of rooting structures. Now, rooting structures clearly evolved before this. So the first evidence of land plants is 460 million years. So it's 50 million years earlier than this. It's likely those plants will have had some rooting structure to anchor them, but we've got no evidence for what that is. But this is a fossil that shows the first evidence of these filamentous rooting cells that I talked about earlier. So these are the rooting cells here. This is an artist's reconstruction of a plant. This is a very poor reconstruction. We're doing a reconstruction on this now, and it looks very different. However, this is the one that's been published previously. And so the plant comprises two axes. There's this vertical axis here, and then this horizontal axis. These vertical axes are radially symmetrical here. And they got water conducting tissue on the inside, and then they got a cortex on the outside, and then an epidermis. Now, if we look at these horizontal axes here, we can see that we now have a bilaterally symmetrical axis. And on the underside of this bilaterally symmetrical axis now, we get these tip-growing filamentous cells. And these are unicellular cells. So there's no, they initiate in the epidermis and they grow out into the soil. So these look very similar morphologically to the cells that I showed you on extant plants, on the mosses, and on Arabidopsis. So if we look closely at these, this is a close-up, we can see what we have here is the epidermis, and every cell in this epidermis is making one of these tip-growing outgrowths, and then it grows out into the soil. And these dense masses of rhizoids will be anchoring these plants in place. Okay, so that's a general introduction to you know, white plants, the place of plants, and the importance of the rooting structures, and what the rooting structures we're going to talk about for the rest of this presentation. So the way I want to split up this talk is I want to talk about two different stories, though they're related. And in the first instance, I want to talk about the genetic mechanism that controlled the formation of these first lamp plant ancestors, and we're going to use comparative developmental genetics to make those statements. And then I'm going to move on to talk about what looks to us like a novel patterning mechanism for cells in an epidermis. And this is work that's very much in progress. And as I said, I'd be very keen to get feedback on the preliminary results that we have for that.
Did you see evidence for chloroplasts in those fossils?
No, we haven't seen that. There is subcellular detail, but we haven't looked at that in... we can see nuclei. We can see other organelles, but we can't for sure say that they're chloroplasts. They're likely there, but we haven't been able to do it. For another fossil project that we've been doing, we've been able to do a 3D reconstruction of parts of meristems, and we can see quite a bit of the three-dimensional structure, but we can't be absolutely sure of the identity of the organelles. It turns out that the carbon material that remains in these is fluorescent in a number of the samples, so we can use a comp photographer. There'll be no DNA. There'll be no... we couldn't do genetics or sequence on them.
Was it volcanic explosion?
Yeah. So it's a geyser system, and so the expectation is that what happened was you had, you know, a catastrophic explosion of silica saturated water, and that the entire environment was preserved at once. And this would have been going on periodically. Parallels have been made with Yellowstone, the type of activity that you see there. But what's different with Yellowstone is that in Yellowstone, when plants are preserved, they take a long time to be preserved in silica, and as a result, there's a lot of decay. There's very little evidence for decay here, so they're instantaneously preserved. So there's something else going on that we don't know. Okay, so I've described to you the two structures of rooting structures that we see amongst the land plants. And this is a family tree of land plants. Now, there's lots of different family trees. This is one that's consistent with the most recent possible models. Irrespective of the topology of this family tree, the conclusions that I'm going to make during the rest of this talk still hold. So what I want you to start with here is these are the streptophyte algae. So these are the group that we say are sister to the land plants. So the streptophyte algae and the land plants shared a last common ancestor here that existed sometime before 460 million years ago. This is the last common ancestor here of the land plants. And there are two monophyletic groups according to this phylogeny. There's the group that are derived from a single ancestor that are non-vascular. So they don't have, what that means is they don't have thickened water transporting cells. This group here are the vascular plants, so they do have these specialized cell walls for transporting water. And it's the ability of these plants to transport water over large distances that release them from the constraint of water transport. So all of the big trees, all the large plants that you see, all have specialized water conducting tissues that allows them to pump water up against gravity to great heights. So this is the vascular plants here. And the seed plants are the plants that you're most familiar with. So most of the plants growing around us here are seed plants. So this includes the gymnosperms, which is the conifers, and the flowering plants, such as the Arabidopsis model system. Over here, we've got three groups, the mosses and the liverworts. And I'm going to spend quite a bit of time today talking about the liverwort. So the comparative analysis that we're adopting is based on the following. If we can identify features or genes and mechanisms that are active here in controlling the formation of these filamentous rooting systems here, and we find similar genes, homologs as such, that control the same process here, then we can reason that that gene or that group of genes acted in the last common ancestor of the flowering plant, of the land plants. And so that's the rationale underpinning the analysis that I'm going to talk about. So let's have a look on one slide at what these tip-growing cells look like. So what we have here is one of these filamentous cells. So this is a tip-growing cell from a liverwort. And Hugh has labeled the single copy row. In plants, it's also called a ROP. So this is a row. There's one copy of it in the Marchantia genome, and it's located at the tip. This is the growing point. And if you look here, we can see that it locates to the membrane. So Rho is controlling the actin dynamics and vesicle fusion at this site where growth is taking place. And this gives you here a feel for what growth, the mechanism, the cytology of the growing point. So what we have here is a thin section through the growing tip. It's immunogold labeled with the cell wall epitope, and so the epitope labels the vesicles in this region, and also they're delivered to the tip. So what's happening here is you've got vesicles that are derived from the Golgi, which in turn derive from the ER, that are fusing with the plasma membrane, and there's a high rate of endocytosis going on. So you're getting membrane cycling that's delivering the cell wall material. So that's the cytology of these cells, and I'm not going to talk about any of the cytology or cell biology of these. The nucleus will be down here. So you've got a nucleus here, and the majority of this cell is vacuole. And there's dense cytoplasm, as you've seen here, just located at the tip. And the nucleus tracks the growing tip. So as the tip grows, the nucleus is following behind. Okay, so what we're doing is we've, about 7 or 8 years ago, we started to work on this plant, Marchantia polymorpha. We'd worked on Arabidopsis before. Our reason for working on Marchantia is twofold. One is the aim to begin to do comparative developmental biology so that we could compare genetic mechanisms in diverse lineages of plants, but there were other reasons too. So the plants that you see around you, the big parts of the plants, they're diploid. The part of this plant that you see is haploid. So it gives us the power to do haploid genetics. So this is the plant, as you will see. It's a common weed, like a lot of model systems. It grows, it produces this thallus, this green thallus, and the bit I'm most interested in is on the underside of this thallus. This is this beard of white cells here. So these grow down into the soil and anchor it in place. And these will grow about 2.5 centimeters into the soil, and they really do anchor it in place, because if any of you have ever had an infestation of these, they're almost impossible to pull out of the soil. You've got to dig them out. Okay. And then experimentally, they're quite a nice system because they produce asexual propagules. So these are little bits of plant, like little embryos, that are developed in these cups. And this is one of them here. And I'm going to talk about these later. These are called gemmae. Okay, and these gemmae produce two meristems. There's a meristem in this notch here and in this notch here. And then if you let this grow for 3 or 4 days, then you can see that they produce these rhizoids that I'm talking about here. So there's lots of benefits to this system. It's transformable, so we can introduce DNA. Dirk?
I have a naive question. So is the shoe tissue also, the growth of the shoe tissue, is that directed by a meristem or is that not?
It's a meristem. Oh, okay. So it's all derived from a meristem.
Okay, cool.
Haploid, it's transformable. And because it's transformable, we can do mutagenesis using tDNA. So tDNA is it's a bacterial piece of DNA that inserts into the genome. So we can use it like a transposon for insertional mutagenesis. We can do UV or EMS mutagenesis. It's amenable to CRISPR. When we start to do the genetic analysis, we put together a genome assembly because it's got quite a small genome. And what was quite nice for us was that the complexity of gene families is quite small. So, for example, I mentioned the Rho gene or the Rho protein earlier. So there's a single Rho protein in the Marchantia genome, whereas in Arabidopsis there are 11 copies. So that means characterizing the Rhos in Arabidopsis is really quite difficult, but in this organism it's much easier. It's got a rapid life cycle, so we can cycle it more quickly than we can cycle Arabidopsis. So we can cycle it in about 4 to 5 weeks. Small size, we can grow at high densities. It's got separate sexes, so there's boys and girls, so we can cross, we can control crosses. And those people who are doing the projects over the next 2 weeks will know that it produces these tiny spores and that they're, you know, a cell biologist's dream. And obviously it's got rhizoids. So there's lots of useful tools for us to exploit. Its natural habitat, as I say, is a weed. So this is it growing in the cracks between two paving stones. It's outside the Sainsbury Lab in Cambridge. This photograph was taken last week. So this is about the size of a nickel here. And what you can see, this is the thallus. And then the star-like structures are the female reproductive organs that form. Okay, so to get going on trying to understand the genetic regulation of these rooting structures, we carried out a large tDNA gene mutagenesis. So we transformed over 300,000 tDNA lines and screen for defects in rhizoid development. So we got lots of mutants that had defects in rhizoid morphogenesis. So the shapes of those cells were abnormal. I'm not going to talk about those for the rest of the day. But we found 6 rhizoidless mutants, or next to rhizoidless mutants. So these plants are perfectly normal, but they didn't produce rhizoids. And then we found 20 mutants that produced ectopic rhizoids. So these are rhizoids that develop on the upper surface of the plant. And a lot of these were tagged, so we were able to show that the tDNA insertion caused the mutation, defined the function of 36 genes, and 20 of these had not been characterized in plants before. So it highlights, the importance of doing a screen in a different organism, you see different genes, but also in doing a genetic forward genetic screen in an organism that's as weird as Marchantia, can identify lots of new gene functions. So I'm only going to talk about 2 groups of these genes today. So this is our wild-type plant. So the thallus is here, and the rhizoids develop on the underside. And we found 2 mutant alleles that gave us this phenotype. So we had a pretty normal thallus, but they produced no rhizoids. And each of these had tDNA insertions into the same gene. So we were pretty sure we had the right gene. And this gene... thanks.
How are they capable of growing if they don't have the rhizoids?
They don't grow very well at all. So they grow in petri dishes with agar medium. And as soon as you... And you've got to keep them pressed into the medium, and then they'll grow well. We can grow them on soil if we keep them in plastic bags and if you're very well watered. And they'll grow along the surface. But then as soon as they reach the edge of the pot and then they lift up, then they shrivel at the edges. So what if they're in direct contact with the soil, they can wick enough water. But as soon as they lift off, they can't wick the water. And these plants, I haven't highlighted this, but they produce rhizoids that go down into the soil, but they also produce a system of rhizoids that run like a pipe underneath, and they transport water from the older part of the thallus to the younger part of the thallus. And in these mutants, the younger part of the thallus is very sensitive to water deficit, and they won't grow. So we've got to really take care of these plants in order to make them grow. But they are viable, which is a lifesaver. So we identified insertions in this gene, so two of them. So these were loss of function mutations. So they're RNA null. So if we measure steady state levels of mRNA for this gene, we don't see anything at all. So you know, if you don't have this gene, you don't make rhizoids. That suggests that it's a positive genetic regulator of rhizoid development. I mentioned this mutant phenotype that we saw, and the difference between this and wild type is that while all the rhizoids develop on the underside of wild type, the rhizoids on the RSL gain-of-function mutant, they develop on the upper side too. So you're getting rhizoids below and rhizoids above. So I got very excited about this. I thought we found some sort of polarity defect. But what it turns out, when we sequence the genomes of all of these, they all had tDNA insertions into the 5' regulatory region of this RSL gene. So that immediately suggested to us that we're getting some sort of enhancer trap effect here. And we tested that hypothesis then by just measuring steady state levels of RSL RNA. So here's a wild type males and females. This is the levels of expression relative to a control. And we can see that in each of the five mutants that we looked at here, the levels, steady state levels of RSL1 RNA were elevated here. So that tells us that what's happening is that the insertion is causing an increase in the expression of the RSL genes in these mutants with dorsal rhizoids. Dirk?
Can you visualize the expression of RNA in this system to see if it's just the same cells expressing more, or is it?
So we haven't done that yet, and we're trying to do exactly that.
Because it could still suggest, like, it could still be polarity with maybe you disrupted a spot where an inhibitor lands or something.
It definitely could be. For us, the simplest explanation is that it's a hypermorphic mutation. So that where the gain of function gives you more rhizoids and the loss of function gives you no rhizoids, there will be physiological knock-on effects. Okay, and I think that there will be probably polarity effects related to that.
So maybe also thinking about spatial relation. So looking from here, I don't know if it's a trick of the image, but it does look like they're focused in the center and maybe far away from the meristem. So is there still kind of the meristems don't create these, and it's only the more mature cells that are capable of doing this?
So we always see this effect that you see them in the more mature areas, and I don't really know why that is. When we first looked at these, we thought that maybe what was happening is that they're initiating here near the meristem, and it just takes us a while to see them, but it's not happening. They're actually initiating later. So there is some sort of repression, and I think I know what that repression is, actually. In the last part of the talk, we've got a repressor, and it looks like it's most active in and around the meristem notch, but we haven't proven it. So, but we can talk about it when I get onto that.
The cells on the bottom, and then also the ectopic sort of rhizoid producing cells. Does every single cell on the surface make them?
No.
Or is it a pattern?
So there's a salt and pepper pattern. I would say it's not random, but we haven't tested that. Okay, so the conclusion you know, despite Dirk's caveat here, is that the RSL genes are necessary for rhizoid development, but they're also sufficient in certain instances for rhizoid development. Now, it turns out that RSL1 encodes a basic helix-loop helix transcription factor. And in plants, these bunches of transcription factors, just like in metazoans, they often control cell fate decisions. And what we wanted to do then was just to see if, you know, what's happening in other organisms. And it turns out that we'd already characterized this gene in moth. So here's the wild-type moth that you've seen before. You get a beard of rhizoids forming. There were two RSL genes in the moth genome. And if you knock out both of those, you get very short rhizoids. And so this indicates that it's necessary for growth. And then if you overexpress both genes, then you get a massive rhizoid forming. So I'll just talk you through these data. So if we plate spores on the surface of agar, we get this network of filaments, and then on these network of filaments, we get these little plants developing. So you can see here with the leaf structures. And so if we look more closely, this is one of these filaments, and then this is a bud here, and this bud here, this part of this bud will go on to form one of these leafy structures. And then at the bottom end of this bud, then we get rhizoids forming. In plants where we overexpress both RSL1 and RSL2, we transform this bud here into a massive rhizoid. So everything gets turned into a rhizoid here. So that indicates the sufficiency. And of course, the same is true in flowering plants. So this is an Arabidopsis plant. Here's a wild type plant with the root hairs growing along the surface. If we knock out the two RSL copies in Arabidopsis, we get no root hairs forming, indicating that it's required for development. And then we've done some work in grasses as well. And in grasses, if you overexpress this gene, you transform every cell into a root hair. So that's quantified here. So what we're looking at here is in the dark part of this bar is the proportion of cells that develop as root hairs in a wild type. So 50% are root hairs and 50% are non-hair cells in wild type. But if we now ectopically overexpress the RSL gene, we turn almost every epidermal cell into a hair cell. So what that tells us is that the RSL genes are positive regulators of rhizoid development in liverworts, mosses, and seed plants. And that allows us to conclude that the common ancestor of these plants will have used RSL genes to control the formation of the first land plant rooting systems. So RSL genes are present in the manilophytes, this is the ferns and horsetails, in the lycophytes and in the hornworts, but we don't have systems in which we can functionally characterize the genes here. So we think that this is a safe conclusion. So the RSL transcription factors will have acted around 460 million years ago to control the formation of the first simple rooting systems that grew by tip growth. So that's the part of my talk that I understand. I don't understand the next part.
So in things like algae, because a lot of these algae, they stick together, don't they, as far as they're aware. So do they have sort of like a root equivalent, which kind of helps them to...
Yeah.
So are these, essentially, is there any sort of...
ancestral stake, yeah. So the sister groups, the group of algae that are most closely related here, don't have any rhizoid-like structure. Then a few branches back, there's a bunch of algae that have developed quite a complex body that traditionally have been considered to be sister to the land plants because of their complexity. But this looks like it's been a secondary evolution of complexity amongst the streptophytes. Now, they do have rhizoids, but our gene 1 isn't present there, and the most closely related gene is not expressed in the rhizoids. The most closely expressed related gene is expressed in the morphogenetic centers, the nearest thing they have to a meristem. So there's 1, they've independently evolved rhizoids, and 2, our genes aren't there doing this job. Okay.
you haven't explained what a rhizoid is in a floating algae.
Okay, so it doesn't. So you don't see it in floating algae. So you only see it in those algae that stick to this, to this, the base of the mud at the bottom of a pond, and there they've been shown to be involved in anchorage and in phosphorus uptake, and their root hairs are important in phosphorus uptake in land plants as well. Okay.
So Liam, I guess there's always a question when you have trees like this of whether it's basal or co-option.
Yes.
Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, so I've studiously avoided that because it could be co-option. The difference between in extant plants, rhizoids develop on the haploid phases of these, but on the diploid phases of these. So based on extant plants, it would suggest that one of these is ancestral and then it's been co-opted into the other. The fossil record is suggesting that rhizoids were, that if we tried to reconstruct what the plants down here looked like, it suggests that there were rhizoids in both the haploid and diploid phases. And if we assume that that's correct, then that would suggest that it hasn't been co-option, but that it was an ancestral function in both generations, and it's been conserved in the diploid generation here and in the haploid generation here.
Can I ask you another question? Any similarity with the filamentous fungi?
No, so the process by which filamentous fungi grow is very similar, evolved independently, but there are no BHLHs like of this class in the fungi. Okay, right. So this is the work in progress where I'd appreciate input. And so what we've done here is we've identified a repressor of this system that we and we've got evidence that it's involved in patterning in these cell types. And we're just beginning to understand what's going on here. And so I'll give you the state of play at the moment. Okay, so I told you that we identified 6 rhizoidless mutants out of that 330,000. Two of them were loss of function alleles in RSL1 gene encoding the transcription factor. 4 others were allelic, so 4 others were mutations in the same gene, and here are 3 of them. So I'm going to show you this gemma structure. This is the asexual propagule that these produce. And if you look at the surface of these, you can see that they produce these relatively large, paler cells, and these are the cells that will go on to form rhizoids. And if we come back 5 days later, this plant will have grown into this, and you can see the rhizoids form. Now, what you can see on each of these mutants, and we've called this few rhizoids one because very occasionally we do get a rhizoid, so it's few rhizoids. The first difference that you see here is that you don't see the pale cells, these large pale cells. So it suggests that rhizoid development is defective very early in this process before you get the large precursor cell. And then, obviously, 5 days later, these plants have not produced a rhizoid. Okay, so we sequenced the genomes, and what we found was that each of these had a tDNA insertion upstream of a 1.2 kb transcript. So we, given our experience with the RSL genes, where when we had insertions in the 5' regions, it resulted in an overexpression of the downstream gene. We tested that hypothesis, and that's the case. So what we have here, this is expression relative to a control. These are the different genotypes. In wild types, we get very low levels of expression, but in each of the 4 mutants, we see much higher steady-state levels of this transcript compared to the wild types. So this suggests that it's an overexpression phenotype of the gene.
Do you have a 35S
in a tDNA? Yeah. So initially when we saw this, we thought that maybe what we were doing is we were identifying negative regulatory regions in promoters, but it's an enhancer trap effect that we're seeing. And it, we get an enhancer trap effect on about 20% of the mutants that we generate. So when I did a similar screen in Arabidopsis, we never saw the gain of function phenotype. So for some reason, but I was delighted with this because it gave us gain of function and loss of function mutants in the same screen. So when we looked at the sequence of this 1.2 KB transcript, it didn't look like anything that we'd seen before. And to cut a sort of an 18-month story down to 10 seconds, there's a microRNA in this region here. So there's a microRNA that's being produced, and when you overproduce this microRNA in these plants, you repress rhizoid development. So to verify that this microRNA, or this gene was producing a microRNA, we reasoned that if it is a microRNA that's the active component of this gene, that we should be able to suppress it if we suppress microRNA biogenesis. And so what we did was we made some mutants of microRNA biogenesis. So this is just lifted from a review, and it shows the process of microRNA biogenesis. So you get the microRNA gene transcribed, and then there's a DICER-like one protein which is involved in processing, and then there's another protein called HASTE that's hypothesized to be involved in transporting the duplex RNA out of the nucleus. And so what we reasoned was, if we could make weak alleles in these genes, so we could decrease the activity of DICER-like 1 or decrease the activity of HASTE, that we should suppress the phenotype if the phenotype is due to the overproduction of a microRNA. Okay, and so what we did is we made mutants in DICER-like 1 in the FRH1 gain-of-function mutant background. So this is a double mutant background, and then this is the FRH1 gain-of-function mutant background. And so we've done this quantitatively, but this is just a nice example, a qualitative representation. So in wild type, we get relatively low levels of the microRNA. We get much higher levels of the microRNA in the gain-of-function mutant. And now if we now make a double mutant where we've got DICER-like 1 in the background, we now reduce the level of the microRNA background in FRH1. And so if our hypothesis is correct, we should see a suppression of the mutant phenotype. And that's what we saw. So what you're looking at here is a wild-type plant that's been grown for 2 weeks. And you can see there's a beard of rhizoids forming just out from underneath the thallus. This is the FRH1 gain-of-function plants, and you can see that there are no rhizoids that are forming here. And in the plants that harbor the weak DICER-like 1 alleles, we can see that we've now restored the formation of rhizoids. So what that's telling us is that the FRH1 gene is encoding a microRNA that is repressing rhizoid development, and it's overexpressed in the gain-of-function background. We've quantified the effect. So we get occasional rhizoids that form, and if you look at wild type, they increase in length from 7 days through 21 days. In the FRH1 gain of function mutant, these are very short. And now if you look at them in the double mutants where we've suppressed the production of microRNA slightly, we can see we restore the phenotype to what we see in wild type. We did this with HASTE, and I'll just run through these quickly. So here's a wild-type plants. After 2 days, they produce rhizoids. The FRH1 gain-of-function doesn't produce rhizoids, and if we now have a HASTE mutation in the FRH1 gain-of-function mutant background, we restore the formation of rhizoids. So this tells us that the FRH1 gene is encoding a microRNA, and the target of that microRNA turns out to be the RSL1 gene. So when we look at the sequence of the microRNA, it almost perfectly matches the sequence that's found just upstream of the basic helix domain in the RSL gene. So if RSL1 is the target of the microRNA, then we would expect that the levels of RSL1 messenger RNA should decrease in an FRH1 gain-of-function mutant background. So what we've done here is looked at levels of RSL1 RNA, so they're quite high here, relative to these are the four mutants where they're decreased. And then these are plants where we've used an actin promoter, which is a strong promoter, to overexpress our microRNA, and we get a reduced expression of RSL1. So that's consistent with the FRH1 microRNA repressing RSL1 activity.
Yeah, do you have any idea what's upstream? In particular, do you think that they may be under the same regulatory pathway? Because my understanding of microRNAs, that's quite a common sort of network.
So I'm going to show you another piece of data, but I don't have an answer of what's upstream of both of them. But what I'm about to show you here is that RSL1 is controlling the microRNA. Okay. So if you look at steady state levels of the FRH1, you can see that in wild type, we've got this intermediate level. In RSL1 loss of function, we see a decrease, and in RSL1 gain of function, we see an increase. So what this is suggesting to us is now that we've got an activator and inhibitor, an activator, a repressor, we say, and that there's a positive and a negative interaction.
Do you think it's direct?
I think this part of it's direct, and we're trying to test if... So this part is direct, and we're trying to test if this part is direct. We don't know the answer to that.
So given that you've looked at RSL1 and Rhabdopsis for a number of years, and the microRNA field is pretty well developed,
I was sure it was going to be there, but we don't see the microRNA, and also the sequence, the target of this microRNA is not conserved in Rhabdopsis, and we don't see any evidence of a conserved region along the Rhabdopsis message that would be consistent with it being a microRNA target. So this looks like it's quite specific for this, and it's really quite different from what's happening in Rhabdopsis.
Does the microRNA move?
We don't know. Okay. That would come up later. I think it probably does. Okay, so we've got this model based on steady state levels of transcription. What we set out to do then is to just test if get functional evidence to support this. And so what we decided to do then was to make an RSL1 version that's resistant to the microRNA. And the way we can do that is that we can introduce 5 mutations into the RSL1 message at the region where the microRNA targets it. So this mutant version should be resistant if this process is controlling rhizoid development. This resistant version should be able to produce rhizoids, whereas the wild type version should not be able to produce rhizoids. And that's what we see. So here's our FRH1 gain of function. So this plant lacks all rhizoids. And if you transform in using an EF1A promoter, so it's expressed throughout the plant, but at a media level, so it's not huge levels of expression, we do not see any restoration. But if we use the same promoter to now transform in a variant of RSL1 that's mutated to the resistance, we can see that we can restore the formation of rhizoids, and we've quantified that here. So in the plants that contain the wild type, we never see rhizoids forming. And in the plants where we see transform with the resistant version, we see rhizoids in almost all of those examples. So this suggests to us that the RSL1 is a direct target, and that it's controlling the formation of rhizoids in this. So this relates to Dominique's question. So we then look to see if the target site of the microRNA was conserved among the land plants. And we see evidence of conservation among the liverwort. So we find it in two of the three groups of liverworts, and it's perfectly conserved. But we don't see evidence of conservation anywhere else. And we looked hard at Arabidopsis for variants of this, and we don't see it. So this looks like it's really something that's quite different from what has evolved to control RSL in Arabidopsis. So what we think we've got here is a system where you've got a BHLH protein that evolved early in land plant evolution to control the formation of these filamentous rooting structures. And then in the liverwort lineage, the FRH1 microRNA evolved as a repressor in controlling the activity of RSL. We know that in Arabidopsis, there's a homeodomain protein called GLABRA2 that has a similar job in controlling RSL1 genes during development. And I don't think that GL2 and the whole mechanism around GL2 is representative of the seed plants. I actually think that it's representative of a bunch of plants around, closely related to Arabidopsis. So I don't think it's doing the same in the grasses. So I think that there's the positive regulatory mechanism is ancient and is being conserved. And what's happening is during the course of evolution, negative regulation is evolving time and again during the course of evolution.
Are you able to express FRH1 in the seed plants?
Yeah, we haven't done it. We could do that. And so that might just...
dysfunctional.
We've looked for targets and we don't see them, but that doesn't mean that they're not there. But we could do that. That's a that's an experiment we could do.
Kind of based on that question, can you weaken the microRNA machinery, like in the root hair cells specifically, to see if there is some conserved microRNA regulation of the root hair cells, but just a different microRNA?
We could and we haven't, but that could be done. If we were to do that, what we wouldn't know is I'm sure that microRNAs are controlling some aspect of root hair development, but they may not necessarily be controlling the RSL pathway. And our thinking on this is that RSL is, if you like, a master regulator for this cell type. So, you express RSL, you produce these rhizoid structures. Okay. So, to summarize that part, where we've got to is we've got this little network where we've got an activator that produces rhizoids, and we've got a repressor that inactivates the activator, but the activator can activate the repressor. So that will all sound familiar to lots of people. So what we set out to do then is to try to get a feel for precisely what mechanism the microRNA is controlling. Is it, you could think on two extremes. You could think that RSL1 is required for the rhizoid cell, or a cell to become specified as a rhizoid cell and then to elongate. And that the microRNA could be there to regulate the levels of RSL1 to regulate, say, the size of that cell or the growth rate of that cell. On the other hand, the other extreme is that it could be involved in spatial patterning of RSL1. So if RSL1 signal tells a cell to become a rhizoid, FRH1 could be expressed in those cells that do not develop rhizoids to inactivate the RSL1 activity there. So this is where we're in the course of doing some experiments to try to figure out which of these is going on. And so here's some background data to explain, to help you follow the next part of the talk. So what we're doing here is we're looking at these gemmae, and these large cells that are outlined in green are the cells that are just about to produce rhizoids. So you see, so here's a rhizoid. We see an individual rhizoid, and it's surrounded by non-rhizoidal cells. So these non-rhizoidal cells are red because the plastids, the chloroplasts in these cells, are at the surface and they're autofluorescent. So you get this red fluorescence. In the rhizoid cells, plastids are much smaller and they're out of the plane of focus here. So it looks like a black background. So that's what we're using to score. And so what I want you to see here is that you can get the majority of these cells in the wild type, and so TAC2 is one of our wild type backgrounds. The majority of these are individual. So we can see an individual cell here, black cell, which is the rhizoid precursor surrounded by the red cells that are the pavement, the epidermal cells, flat epidermal cells. We've got a bunch of three of these rhizoids in a linear arrangement here, and then we've got another three here. And so if we quantify the arrangement of these cells, we see that in wild type, see, approximately 65% of the cells are individual in wild type. And then we get decreasing percentages in, say, in these linear arrangements of two cells or three cells. And we never see anything in wild type above six cells. So very rarely we'll see six cells in a linear row, but it's always linear. If we now look at the plant that's overexpressing ORSL1, so that's the positive regulator, we can see that we tend to get bigger clusters. Okay, so there's more green here than there is here. But when we quantify it, we can see that still the majority of cells are single cells. But what we do, but there are less than in wild types. And so what we seem to do when we overexpress ORSL1 is we move this curve this way slightly. So we get seven cell clusters, but we get some clusters that are over 10 cells. So we get some of these really large cells. So we're just shifting the equilibrium in another direction. So overexpress ORSL1, you tend to get larger clusters. And just to remind you, in the mutant where you knock out ORSL1, you don't get any of these clusters forming.
Question?
Yeah.
Question, so those percentages, how do those compare to a randomized distribution?
Good question. We haven't done that. So we haven't done that. I don't think it's randomized because of the very large number of single cells that we see, but we haven't done it.
Yeah, I think it would be easy to do because you take the same distributions and just like randomize the assignment.
So we could do, and we could use the data we already have to test that.
Can you tell anything about relationship, like lineal relationships?
No. Not yet. So this is, I'll talk a little bit about that later because it might help us try to interpret it, but we're thinking about that and trying to understand it. So we don't know the answer. Okay, the aim of this set of experiments is to understand the role of the microRNA. And the only genetic material that I described with respect to the microRNA thus far has been plants that overexpress it. So you express shed loads of this repressor and you just shut down rhizoid development. So what we want to do is do the opposite experiment. We want to make loss of function mutants. And so what we did is we made a number of different lines where we deleted the microRNA gene. So it is a wild type representative of this is this 1.2 KB transcript that's overexpressed in the gain of function mutant. And then the red region here is the region where the microRNA is encoded. And so we've made different deletion variants where we've deleted different parts of this transcript. But what's common amongst all of these is that we don't have any of the microRNA code left. And if we now measure or look at the levels of microRNA, and we've done this quantitatively, but I'm going to show this qualitative. These are the various loss of function mutants here. We cannot detect any of the microRNA transcripts here, but in the wild type we do. So we're pretty sure that these are RNA null. So there's no microRNA being produced.
Why didn't you try CRISPR and just mutate?
We've done that too. We've done that and we get exactly the same result. And given that our hypothesis is that FRH1 is repressing ORSL1, We measured RSL1 levels in these gain-of-function backgrounds, and what we find is that the levels, these are two wild-type controls, we find that the levels of RSL1 is generally elevated in the loss-of-function FRH1 background compared to the wild-type. Now, in some instances, it's not statistically significant, but we're expecting in these cases that there's only a few cells, not all of the cells are going to be expressing it, so we're talking about small changes. But the trend is that if we knock out FRH1, we increase the steady state levels of the RSL1 message. Okay, so what do these plants look like? So here's two wild types. So you've seen these before. So you tend to get, most of them are unicell clusters. Occasionally you get these larger clusters, and that's indicated here. So 63% single cell clusters, and then decreasing numbers of clusters here. In this loss of function 7 allele, what you can see is that there's a reduction in the number of those one cell clusters, and we can see up to 9 cell clusters. So it's just like the RSL overexpression experiment, that you knock out the FRH1, you tend to increase the size of the clusters. And that's exactly what you'd expect for a system where these are interacting. And to show that that's not an artifact, we're able to complement the mutant. So if we take an FRH1 mutant and now introduce the wild-type copy of the gene, we don't get any of these large clusters. So here's a large cluster you see in the FRH1. Loss of function mutant background, you introduce the wild type gene, these all disappear and you only see these small clusters. I haven't quantified that here for simplicity. So we can complement phenotype, so we know we've got a real phenotype. So what I've shown you in those last few slides is that in the FRH1 loss of function mutant, we tend to change the relative frequencies of clusters, cell number per cluster. So you knock out the FRH1, you tend to get slightly bigger clusters, but you know it's not a dramatic difference. What I'm going to show you in the next slide is the arrangements of cells in the clusters. And I want to make a distinction, because what we see in wild type is we tend to see linear clusters. And this is schematically represented here, where you get a chain of cells, and each one of these cells, so in this case, so the cell on the end has one neighbor that's a rhizoid, the cell in the middle has two cells that are rhizoids, neighbors, and then the cell on this end has a single rhizoid neighbor. Whereas in clusters like this, each of these rhizoid cells has two rhizoid neighbors. Okay. And we've used this neighbor number as a proxy to help us understand the orientation of cells in these clusters. Okay. So we're making a cluster shape index, which is just based on the numbers, the average numbers of neighbors in a cluster. So as I said, this cell has a single rhizoid neighbor, this has two rhizoid neighbors, this is a single. And if we take the average, so that's 1 plus 2 plus 1 divided by 3, we get 1.3. And if we have a cluster that looks like this, we get a linear the cluster value of this. So these relative size of these numbers gives us an indication of how clustered these are. So what I'm going to show you on the next slide is a comparison of three cell clusters in wild type and the different mutants. Okay, so here's a linear cluster, here's a nonlinear cluster. Each of these clusters have three cells. And here in wild type, as I suggested, you have this 1.3. And you always get 1.3. So for me, the important piece of this data isn't the 1.3, but it's the standard error here. So you don't get any variation from this. And what happens in the different gain of function, in the different FRH1 loss of function mutants, is that you see an increase in this value. So you're seeing more, most of the cells in the FRH1s have more rhizoid neighbors. So they're not forming a linear array, they're more two-dimensional.
So when is this happening? is there cell division still going on?
We're trying to figure that out now. So this is exactly, so we're trying to sort out the lineage and trying to figure out the division, because, and I think you're driving at it, maybe that a cell is committed to be rhizoid and then it divides and it stays rhizoid. And if that were true, that would be quite, I'd be surprised, but it could be. And it could be that the microRNA is involved in suppressing that. And yeah, so we can talk about that later. So in these, I mean, not only is the value higher, but the variability is higher. So we're seeing not just this change in orientation, but we're seeing lots of variability in the orientation of these cells. If we now look at a four-cell cluster, so if we have a linear array, we'd expect a CSI value of 1.5. In a non-linear array, such as this one, we get a value of 2. And again, in the wild types, we always see 1.5. There's no variance here. Okay, but that level is always, the number of neighbors is always higher in the mutants, and their values are much more variable. So we're getting variable states. And so the way I'm thinking about this is in wild type, we're getting linear, one-dimensional arrays of rhizoid cells when we see them. And in the mutant, we're seeing two-dimensional arrays. And then if we look at a cluster of five cells, we see the same general trend. Here's the wild-type values, and there's no variance. And we see much higher variance, higher values, and much higher variance in these sectors. So what this is doing is it's giving us a measure to begin to think about how these cells are oriented. So there's an image missing there. Let me just go on to this summary. So what we've done is we've measured these clusters in all the different mutant backgrounds. And what we see in all the mutant backgrounds, we always see an increase in this CSI value. And we always see a higher variance than we see in wild type. We see in 3-cell clusters, 4-cell clusters, and 5-cell clusters. So what this is telling us is that the shapes of these clusters is different in the wild type and the mutant. And so in wild type, we tend to see this arrangement. And in the mutants, we tend to see this arrangement. So simplistically, I call this our one-dimensional arrangement, and this is our two-dimensional arrangement. And you know, that's basically where we are. We're really just characterizing this phenotype to try to figure out what's going on here. And given that this is a microRNA, and as Dirk suggested, there's a propensity for microRNAs to move from cell to cell. So it may be that what we have here is a repressor that's moving into adjacent cells. But it's more than just that. It's not doing it equally. There's some directionality to this movement. And we're trying to figure this out. So this is our big question now, is how we get to the bottom of this, you know, how the microRNA is controlling how directionality of this microRNA is controlling the development of these clusters.
So why do you think you need directionality? Isn't it just how cliquey the group is? Right, so if you're very cliquey, then you're sharing, your microRNA concentration is going to be higher.
How do you mean cliquey?
So if you're square.
Yeah.
Right, so if more of your neighbors are also producing the microRNA.
But the square ones are not producing the microRNA.
But from feedback, they certainly not. Or you're unable to dilute the microRNA so much. So when you're selecting for having low numbers of neighbours producing the microRNA.
Yes. Yeah, and the microRNA is responsible for that.
Yeah.
So that's absolutely right.
That wouldn't require any directionality of transport.
But then if you but it doesn't explain. So why do you get a 4-cell square rather than a 4-cell linear?
So it's a hexagonal array, right, rather than a square array.
it can be, but actually we should talk about this, because it could be.
There are other people here much more qualified.
So it's funny, because the student said, no, this is there's no directionality here. She says it's a characteristic of the field. Whereas my interpretation is that there has to be some directionality here. But we could talk about this.
Does the directionality align with the axis of growth?
No correlation. There may be, but we haven't found it yet. It doesn't seem to.
How about the plasma desmata?
Don't know. So there's one other piece of information that it's preliminary, that it's helping us think about what's going on here. And that's, it is preliminary data. So what we've done here is we've taken the promoter of the FRH1 gene and linked it up to YFP. And so it's a promoter reporter. So there's also the caveats why this might not be a true reflection, but let's say it is. What we see is that the FRH1, so the microRNA gene, is expressed in the rhizoid. So it's expressed in the cells where whose fate it represses. Okay. So what could be happening here is that RSL1 could be expressed over a field of cells, and it stochastically increases the expression of FRH1 in one cell, and then that microRNA could then move from that cell into neighboring cells and repress RSL. So we've got no evidence to show that the microRNA is moving, but these data are consistent with the data that we have thus far. And we're in the process of trying to localize the FRH1 microRNA and identify the cells in which the FRH1 microRNA is transcribed. And we haven't done that yet, but we're trying to do that. So, just to summarize, what we have is a mechanism with feedback, where we've got an activator and a repressor, and I've talked you through all of these phenotypes. We see the same basic phenotype when we overexpress the activator and knock out the repressor, and equally when we lose the activator and overexpress the inhibitor, we see the same effects. And what we are trying to do now is to understand precisely the role of FRH1 in the patterning of these processes. So what I've told you today is I started with some description of the history of the rooting systems, and told you that our work in fossils has identified tip-growing rooting structures back in the early Devonian period. I then went on to say how we can use comparative developmental genetics to begin to make statements about what genetic mechanisms will have controlled the formation of these structures in long extinct plants. And then I ended up by describing what we think is a novel microRNA-based patterning mechanism for these cells here. And I should thank Suvi, who discovered the microRNA, and Susanna and Anna, who've done the microRNA work more recently, and Sandy's done the fossil work, and Elaine did the RSL work. And what I'm showing here are, for the benefit of the students on the course, this is the very early stages in spore development, and this is a manifestation of the polarity that you see. So just after the first cell division, we can see this marks endocytosis. High levels of endocytosis at the apical pole, very little at the basal pole, and then after the asymmetrical cell division, then you can see high levels of endocytosis, the rhizoid develops, and then over the entire surface is this generative cell, which goes on to form the rest of the plant form. And these people gave us money to do the research, and so thank you.